major points of difference between Jung's approach to the God image and the traditional, especially the traditional Christian God image, is that the traditional Christian God image tends to be exclusively light and loving and benevolent. You know, like the first letter of John says, he is only light and in him there is no darkness. That's very typical. I mean, there's a bit of, well, it's more than a bit. I mean, in the book of Revelation, you've got the avenging angels, who can be a little bit unpleasant. But by and large, the Christian God image is all good and all light, which was one of Jung's complaints, because he felt that if you just look at the world around us, that we have to have a God image that includes the dark side. I think he would refer to events like the Holocaust or Hiroshima or those kind of horrendous events as attributable to the dark side of the self. And this was one of the main bones of contention with some Christian theologians like Victor White and so on, which is another subject. But the reality is that the archetype or the self can manifest itself in ways that are very painful and frightening. But even though it's painful and frightening, like a nightmare, it's still very, very numinous. So, for example, a woman dreams that she is being chased by the head of her mother, and just the head, not the body. And instead of hair, her mother's head is covered in snakes, like the head of the Medusa or the Gorgon. And this is completely terrifying to her. And she's running up and down staircases, and this head is following her and laughing at her because she can't escape and so on. And in the dream, it's nightmarish, completely terrifying. But it's also extremely numinous. It's mysterious, tremendous. If you think about it, it's mysterious, tremendous, fascinating. So it would be an example of the dark side of the numinosum. There is some... I can tell you, if you're interested in this subject, there is a religious experience research unit at the University of Wales, and they have lots of papers on their website with different kinds of numinous experience. It's not a Jungian website, it's just a collection of religious experiences. They don't use the word numinous because they don't have a Jungian orientation, but that's what they are. And there's one paper where a woman has collected a whole series of demonic apparitions, in which demonic figures that are, you know, grinning, horned, terrifying, goblin or gremlin-like appearances appear to people in a visionary form. So, but the accounts are all very numinous; they just happen to be terrifying. So it's very important to acknowledge that this. The self has a dark side. The archetype can appear in a helpful, healing aspect or a terrifying aspect. It's still trying to point out something to the dreamer. I mean, in that case, it's giving her an image of what her mother was really like. It says a tremendous amount in one image. But it's a good example of the dark side of the archetype. In this case, the mother archetype, obviously. So that's an important point. So I see in the description that I was supposed to say something about the new God image. Jung well, then I said I would have questions, so I'll come back to that. Let's have some questions.
If you have a question, please use the mic.
Or a comment. If you have any criticisms, give them to Deb.
So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about how to integrate these luminous experiences into yourself and into your daily life.
Well, that's partly a therapeutic question, because the question, if they arise in therapy, is how do you help someone integrate this material? But if you're not in therapy and you have one of these experiences, what you have to do is see in what way is it connected to some important situation in your life. Sometimes it's a developmental difficulty, sometimes it's a complex, sometimes it's an illness. But what I found is that these experiences are not random. That if you look at the content of the experience, they always seem to connect to some aspects of the subject's psychology. So you have to try and find out what part of me is that's talking about. It's like a dream. You work on it just as if it was a dream, and say, what is this? What about me is this talking? What is this talking about me? You know, is it a shadow figure or whatever? That, and I think that's just like working with a dream, really. I think that's how it should be done. And for therapists who hear these experiences, the important point, well, I mean, it sort of depends. I was going to say the important point is to validate the experience and explain that it comes from the autonomous psyche and so on. But the difficulty is that somebody could bring in an experience like this, and the therapist might be an atheist. The therapist, there's a high incidence of atheism among psychologists and psychotherapists, much higher than in the general population. I forget the numbers, but it's much higher. So if the therapist's sort of metaphysical commitments are different than the client's, the therapist is in the position of having to say, oh, you know, what were you smoking? Or, you know, you're hallucinating, or you've got temporal lobe epilepsy or something. Or you know, that would be a reductive approach to these experiences. Saul's experience on the road to Damascus has often been reduced to temporal lobe epilepsy. Hildegard of Bingen, who had many of these kind of experiences, was often thought to have a form of migraine. And when you get a bad migraine attack, you get vasoconstriction of the blood vessels in the brain, and you can get apparently these kind of visual phenomena. Saint Teresa of Avila was considered to be a religious hysteric. So it's very easy to reduce these kinds of experience. If you have the experience, after my father died, my mother had a waking vision of him at the foot of her bed. And this is very common in widows. So what do you say to someone who has that kind of experience? If you don't believe that there is a spiritual dimension, or that there is a continuation of consciousness after death in some form, it's so easy to say, well, this was a wish-fulfilling hallucination. You know, you can't bear the loss and so on, you know, that kind of... So it's very easy to reduce this kind of experience and not take it seriously. And when that happens, it can be quite devastating to the subject, because these experiences, I think, should be taken, as Otto says, they are experiences sui generis, of their own kind. They are a category, an ontological category in their own right, and they should be taken at face value, and I think he's right about that. And certainly Jung would say that. But there is a tendency, you know, among the materialists to reduce these experiences. So much depends on who you're talking to. That's why they say the difference between the mystic and the schizophrenic is that the mystic knows who not to talk to. So you do have to be careful about who you talk to about these kind of experiences. Anyway, that's a long-winded answer to that question. So, any more comments or questions?
So you mentioned the self as an image of the divine in the psyche.
Yeah.
Can you also see it in playing other functions that you don't
yes.
have to do?
Yeah, I mean, the self is at once the I'm just sort of paraphrasing Jung, the center of gravity of the personality, and also it's the totality of consciousness and the unconscious. And when you think of the self as the totality of the whole thing, that puts Jung in line with the non-dual spiritual traditions, like Advaita Vedanta and some of the Buddhist and Taoism and so on, where there is only the self, or there is no self, which I think is the same thing. But you know, or like in the Bhagavad Gita, where it says it's the same self in all of us. I think Jung says something similar to that. So the self is supposed to be the organizing principle, it's the archetypal basis of the ego. It has all kinds of functions in the psyche. Yeah. It's a God term. Whenever you don't know what's doing something, you say God did it, or we say the self did it. The question is, what is the relationship Or is there, or do you know if there's a relationship between the image that you get and the divine itself? That's the million-dollar question that's actually unanswerable. Jung says we know there's some kind of relationship between them, but we don't exactly know what it is. You can't... all religious experience is... all experience occurs in the psyche. You can't have an experience without the psyche. So you can't get outside the psyche. So unless you're doing theology, you can't talk about something beyond the psyche. So he says, I don't want to do theology, I want to stay empirically with what can be observed in the psyche in these kind of experiences. Whether there's a transcendent divinity beyond the psyche is a different question that he thinks you can't address. He's a Kantian in that sense. He thinks you can't get there from here. So. Anyway, so the new God image is going to include the dark side. It has to have the dark side to it. So that suffering and evil have to be included. That evil, for example, should not be attributed solely to human beings. Jung thinks that would minimize its gravity. Remember, he objected to the Augustinian notion of evil as the privation of good, evil as the absence of good. He thought that that didn't do justice to the seriousness of evil, that evil is a positive force in the world. So it has to have a dark side and it has to have a feminine aspect. He felt that Christianity, for instance, had split off the feminine aspects of the divine too much. And so that the new God image has to include the feminine aspects of the divine as well. And then it can take all these different forms. It doesn't have to be restricted to one form, like Jesus Christ or whatever is your particular tradition. It can take any number of forms. So that's what I meant in the little description in the brochure about the new God image. Anyway, any more comments?
I'm a sampling therapist.
Yes.
And so we see these experiences in the sand from even very young children.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I notice is that it affects me very deeply as a therapist to witness,
yes,
often in silence, the building of this luminous experience,
yeah, that
this child or adult has. And I've seen young children reach very, very high on my shelves for Shiva, for instance, way out, you know, a Guatemalan adoptee, so far away from his experience.
Yeah.
And typically I experience it in my body as well.
Yeah.
He's experiencing it. Is that something you...
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. I think that's a very important idea, that what happens in any kind of psychotherapy, Senplay or verbal therapy, that sometimes you feel the presence of the self in the room. And it's a somatic experience, it's a bodily experience. All religious experience is bodily experience. If it's just in the head, it's meaningless. So it is felt deeply in the body. But somehow, I guess kids are good at constellating the experience of the self. Well, I don't suppose it's the ego that's doing it. It's probably the self that's moving them to imagine itself in the sand, I would say it that way. They're in touch with it because their egos are less developed, and so they are just guided to that. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that the body is very important in that respect.
Thank you. Someone else?
I'm curious about the transpersonal level. You know, I'm thinking of the image that you add of the triangles and the billions of us that there are. That this...
I meant them to look like icebergs.
Yes. You called it an iceberg. Yes.
Yeah.
And so then we move from that to the personal.
Yeah.
And these personal experiences, either a dream or visions.
Yeah.
And they seem, they're not random, but I can't understand why. If there's this massive transpersonal,
yeah,
and then the experience of a vision seems to have a very personal quality,
yeah,
to it.
Right.
As though this transpersonal layer,
yeah,
is not, it is both transpersonal, but it's also
personal.
Experienced,
yeah,
extremely personally.
Yeah.
So it's not really a question exactly, but I would still love to hear,
yeah,
your thoughts about it.
Yeah, it's an interesting point that these experiences are very specific.
Yes.
And your point is important because there's any number of them that can occur, and they're different for everybody, and yet and they're highly focused, and they're sort of tailored to the individual. Well, it seems to be that the self knows what you need at the moment, and it gives you just the thing that you need, just the symbolic material that you need. That's why I call it an intelligence. It's like that old argument among theologians about whether the divine is transcendent or immanent, you know, which is kind of... it just manifests itself in very specific ways. I can't explain that. It's just part of the intelligent order of the universe. It just does that.
I'd like to thank you for talking about this material you have for years, and it's why I entered Jungian work, because I knew that Jung was interested in the numinous.
Yeah.
And I'm continually surprised at how rarely it's in conversation in training here, and I would imagine many places, and I thrive. It's like mana from the gods. And it's so a part of me, and I don't feel like it's even discussed mostly, the numinous.
Yeah, well, you know, what's happened is there's been so much emphasis on learning relational psychotherapy and object relations theory and all that kind of stuff, mm-hmm, which has an important place, that this aspect of Jung has tended to be marginalized a little, mm-hmm, bit. Which is partly why I'm here, actually.
That's
my
hidden
agenda.
I wanted to come.
Now I'm not
here
so
either.
Hidden, thanks to you.
Thank you for your work.
Yeah, but I agree that has happened. So let me, if I could, if you imagine that this is this archetypal level of the psyche, this is the, by the way, that, you know, that, so I was saying that the ego is here, is quote unquote up here, and down there is the depths of the psyche. It's very important when we use the term depth psychology or deep psyche not to think literally, because to get to the archetypal level, you don't have to rip up the carpet, it's in the room. This level is here right now. Okay, so all our egos are here, but the transpersonal level is also here. So the word depth is a bit misleading and shouldn't be taken literally. It's just a metaphor. Anyway, if you think about the structure of a complex, you have, let's say it's the mother complex or the father complex. You have an archetypal core to the complex, and then you have a shell around it of human experiences, of images, thoughts, feelings, memories of your mother or father. And as that slowly develops in childhood, you end up with a complex that has the archetypal core of the mother or father archetype with the shell of the personal mother and father memories of that. Everyone's familiar with the notion of the complex. All the personalistic theories like Melanie Klein and Freud and
Kohut and all those theories, object relations theory, they're all dealing with the human shell of the complex. Jung is dealing with the archetypal core of the complex, like the woman who dreamed of the mother's head is a Medusa. That's an example of the arc, but there are many examples of that I could give you. So, you actually, to do good therapy, you need both. You can do reasonably good personalistic therapy ignoring the archetype, but if you ever see an archetypal manifestation, it's important to know what it is. You can combine the two. And if you're aware that this larger presence is in the room, you're doing therapy with a spiritual sensibility. And you know that when a person is struggling with a mother or father complex, it's as if they're struggling with the self. That's why it's so emotionally difficult to deal with these complexes. And that gives you a whole different take on the problems of doing therapy with this kind of mother or father material. Hmm. It's struggling with a god, essentially, or a goddess. And that's when you have that sensibility, you're doing psychotherapy as a spiritual practice, which was what that book was about. So I don't know what we can do to get this back into the Jung Institutes. What do you think? I don't know.
Well, you're here.
Yeah, but anyway.
I think the word was marginalized. It's
yeah.
Like the divine is marginalized.
Yeah, well, and people are embarrassed about it.
Ashamed?
Yeah, they don't want to talk about it. It sounds too woo-woo. They want to be scientific.
There's a sense of being out of control.
But you can't be scientific about this stuff. Sorry?
There's a sense of being out of control.
Oh, that's exactly right. Yes.
When you have them.
Yeah.
There's a sense of being out of control when you have those experiences.
Yes.
So I imagine there's a... Let's just marginalize it. Let's not really pay too much attention to it. It'll go away.
I think that's right. I think that's why mainstream psychology is not terribly interested in this, because you remember that famous comment of Einstein that not everything that counts can be counted and not everything can be counted counts. But this is not the kind of stuff that you can measure. You can't quantify this, and they like to think of themselves as scientists and they want to measure everything. They have the measurement mania. And as soon as you start measuring things, you remove yourself from the quality, the subjective quality of the experience. And so that's not amenable to a positivistic, materialistic, scientific approach to the psyche. That's the difficulty. Yeah.
I have a question. I just saw attachment theory and how attachment theory relates to all this.
Attachment theory would be part of the human shell of the complex, which is deriving its emotional power partly from the archetypal core.
I'm just wondering if people with an attachment to some kind of transpersonal experience find that healing. Well, I guess that's what we're talking about.
That's what we're talking about. The important point is not to freeze the symbol. When you have one of these experiences, it can be quite temporary. Mm. It doesn't mean that in a year's time you won't have another big dream with a different kind of symbolic experience. If you freeze the symbol and say, oh, this is it, then you've started a new religious tradition, a new fundamentalism. And that's what we have to avoid that. These are only temporary stepping stones. New things happen all the time. That's what the individuation process is all about. So it's important not to freeze the symbol into something ultimate.
Which is human tendency.
Yes, of course, yeah, because it's so reassuring. Then you have the truth.
I have a question. Sorry, this brings back, I've been in some Lacanian talks, and they have this idea that Jungian, or I heard some comments about Jungian analysis, is one about completing yourself. They believe more in like there is never like completion, you know, you keep searching, but I guess I just want to clarify that because I was a little bit like, why do they see it as, they don't believe that you can ever kind of close yourself or complete, so I guess I just have, I would like some clarification around that, if it's true that this is what you're
Well, the theory is that you're talking about the process is called the process of individuation.
Yeah.
And the theory is that you can never fully individuate. You can get it's like an asymptotic line. You can get closer and closer, but the unconscious is inexhaustible, so that there is constantly new material emerging all the time. So you can never absorb all of it. So you can never. You would have to be the self, and not the ego, in order to individuate fully, as it were. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But individuation is a lifelong process that never quite finishes.
So the self is never complete?
No, the experience of the self is never complete. We're assuming that the self itself, whatever that is complete. We don't know what that is, so I'm talking nonsense now. And we don't know what the unconscious is. Jung says it's only a posit, POSIT. We don't know what it is. It's just another word for the unknown. We really have no idea what it is. But it's inexhaustible, that's the point. And it's always producing new material. Every night you could have a completely different dream until the moment you die. So you can never stop trying to assimilate this kind of material. Yes, let's hand over the...
I just was interested in what you were saying about this connects to the idea of the inexhaustibility that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see if you could connect that to the new God image and this idea that you're talking about something that's changing and it's temporary,
yeah,
as opposed to something that's eternal.
Yeah.
I mean, those two sides. How does that, is that part of this new God image?
Yes, in the sense that no symbolic experience should be taken to be the last word. Like if you think that Jesus Christ is the last word, you've frozen the experience of the self into one particular image. But new imagery keeps happening all the time. So I don't know how else to describe this. Does that answer your question or not? Freezing the symbol means you become a fundamentalist. There are Jungian fundamentalists. I could give you some names and addresses.
I wanted to comment on the description of your talk. You mentioned something about Jungian analysis as being the new sort of, or a new way of looking at spiritual direction, which has been a discipline that's been around for so long. And in that discipline, you're always talking about the presence of God and how is God working in your life. It's almost sort of the formative stuff of the conversation. Whereas there's this whole phenomenological world out there too. So, you know, living in a transcendent way is not necessarily healthy either. So, I guess it's, and then of course there's sort of the need to actualize with data these experiences in some way, and you'll see people like Dean Radin and,
mm-hmm,
and those sorts of folks that are,
yeah,
trying to help those scientific minds to,
yeah,
realize this stuff is real. But I was so curious to hear how to get unstuck from sort of the realm of the spiritual versus maybe it's the idea of the integration of the spiritual. It's a lot of what you're talking about, how to integrate these numinous experiences,
mm-hmm,
in a meaningful way without sounding like maybe you're psychotic,
yeah,
because that's sort of where you want to dwell in some,
yeah,
ways. But,
yeah,
you can't. Because you got a little life. So, I don't know, I'm probably not making any sense. See, this is what I'm talking about. Case in point.
You know, I have a general grasp of what you're saying. If you're in a specific, if you're a spiritual director, suppose you're a Roman Catholic spiritual director, I recently helped a friend of mine who's a Jesuit write a Jungian approach to the spiritual exercises of Ignatius. So we've had this conversation ad infinitum. So he's trying to update those spiritual exercises to make them more accessible to modern people using Jungian language.
Is he here in Boston by any chance?
No, he's not. Okay. Sorry. But I can give you his email address. Very nice guy. So, but he has a narrow. If I was a directee of his and I said, look, I had this vivid dream of a Hindu god who came to me, Shiva came to me, he would say, he wouldn't take it very seriously. So it wouldn't be spiritual direction in this sense. In this sense, that would be taken very seriously. Why is it that specific god and not any other? There are thousands of gods in the pantheons. You'd have to look at the specific characteristics of the, and you'd take it very seriously at face value. You wouldn't try to confine the appearance of the divine to one specific image. I think that's the major difference. I don't know if that's any help to answer
your
question.
Well, it's a good comment, and I appreciate it. I think it just, there is obviously a very expansive way to exist within the realm.
Another argument that I just had with this friend of mine was, see, people often who've been raised in, say, a Christian tradition say that I'm suffering terribly, God has withdrawn from me. If God was present, I wouldn't be feeling like this. That's why I'm depressed and so on. See, I would say, no, God is present as the depression, in the form of the depression. It doesn't mean that because you're miserable, God has gone away. It's just present in a way that you're not used to thinking about. He couldn't accept that. That was one of the main, that's the dark side of the self. One of the main arguments that Jung had with Victor White and so on. So I would say the Jungian approach is broader in its acceptance of the variety of manifestations of the sacred.
Well, and also, and I'll stop, but there's the whole interfaith spiritual direction, but even that, you're still in faith traditions.
Yeah, you're
you're talking about takes you beyond that into
the mythopoetic realm, yeah. Where that's why I think Otto's criteria and James's criteria are useful. Because when you've had an experience, somebody can say to you, well, what makes you think that was an experience of the sacred or the holy? And I would say, well, I have to have some criteria, so I use Otto and James. You could use, what's that woman called who wrote the big book? Evelyn Underhill. She has her own. There are other people who have other criteria. I just am to like these. But you need some criteria, otherwise you're just making stuff up, I think. So, anyway, you have to find some way of recognizing it. And I recognize it by its emotional quality and its healing effect. Oh yes, coming past.
Could you pass the mic over there? Just speak right into it, please.
Fine. We haven't really talked about trauma, and
how long do you want to be here?
So do you want to talk about trauma? And I was wondering if you would want to comment on Donald Kalshett's second book, in particular, as this new, an attempt to create a new.
A new approach to trauma. Yeah, I thought it was. I think it's an important contribution. And he's describing these kind of numinous inner figures. It remains to be seen if they really are protecting the individual the way he says. I think he might be right. I think it's a little bit early to tell, but he might be right about that. I mean, they could be transference figures. Some of these toxic internal images that people have could be transference figures, but he's such a nice guy that you wouldn't think of him in those terms. So I'm not 100% sure that he's right, but in principle, he's right that people have these kind of internal experiences all the time. I don't know what else to say about it. Does that answer your question? Maybe not.
Well, you were talking about a new way of approaching the Godhead or...
Yeah. Well, I think he's on a similar, he's doing a similar approach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The difficulty is when somebody is severely traumatized, it raises the issue of what Jung calls the telos of the personality. This is T-E-L-O-S, the notion that the personality has its own destiny. And that he says, you know, he says, who you are happens to you. The unconscious comes at you from the outside as well as from the inside. Inside in the form of dreams, but outside in the form of major events like traumas, good or bad. So that these terrible things can be seen as the unconscious happening to you from the outside, because they are part of the inevitable telos of your personality. And that's a lot to swallow if you've just been raped or something. It's really a really serious point of view, and it's not clear that he's right. He seems to be right, but it means that whatever happens to you in a big way like that is part of your destiny. And you have to fight. It's like, how do you work with the dark side of the self? That would be an experience of the dark side of the self. How do you come to terms with it in your life? Which raises the whole issue of free will. If the personality has a destiny, is there really such a thing as free will? Jung says, well, free will means doing what you have to do, doing willingly what you have to do anyway. But I mean, there are very profound philosophical questions in which I don't pretend I can solve, but they're interesting issues. Yes.
I was just, when I read his book, what really struck me was this idea that there's this protection factor in the psyche, that when you've experienced something, you know, you really can't handle, that it sort of takes it out of sort of your everyday realm and stores it, I'm maybe doing disservice to him, and stores it somewhere else. That has its negative side, because then you don't have access to what might be a really important part of yourself.
And it prevents you living fully sometimes. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he might be right about this. I mean, it's a new idea and it hasn't been fully assimilated, but I think he might be on the right track. There's certainly in the book he describes very numinous experiences. My only objection to the book, and I put this in my review of his book, which I wrote for one of the journals, is he tries to link it to the brain. And I think it's a mistake to try to link these experiences to the brain. The soul is not found in the brain. These are experiences of the soul. And I think this will get us into philosophical deep water very quickly. But I don't think you can find them in the brain. I think that's a mistake.
Can you just repeat the book?
What was the book called? What was the book? What was the second book called? No, I can't remember the title of the second book. Trauma and the Soul. Trauma and the Soul. It's very well worth reading. It's got some really wonderful stuff in it. Don Kalshed. Okay, I'm surprised you haven't had him here. You should be. He's really a very, very good speaker.
He has
very,
come.
Very
he has come.
He's one of these guys that's very charismatic and convincing, so you have to be careful.
Did you say something about the dark side of nature and the climate events?
Oh.
We had three major flood, wind, whirlwind, etc., that eclipse everything, you know, ego, everything. But they're happening in a collective way.
Well, I would say that, you know, the self, I mean, this gets into my own spiritual commitment, which is that the self is manifested as the totality of nature as well as the psyche. There's really no separation between nature and the psyche. That's just a personal belief. So I think those would all be experiences of the dark side of the self. Where it gets silly is to start saying they're punishments. And right. That's ridiculous. That's importing these silly notions from classical theism into depth psychology, which is a mistake. Mm-hmm. But certainly you can see them as manifestations of the dark side of the self, or the unconscious of the earth coming in a negative form, something like that.
I wonder if the ego complex has made the dark side of the self so manifest in the natural events that have happened, that we've been in an ego complex.
Oh yeah, a cultural
complex. As a culture.
Yeah.
As a people, uh-huh. without being conscious of the self,
that's
which is in nature,
cool.
and the
yeah.
the whole question of the feminine,
yeah.
which has been suppressed.
Yeah.
And so it feels to me as if we have done this through the ego complex.
Unconsciously. Yeah, so as part, you're quite right, so as part of the new God image, you're going to have to include the natural world as well.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to write about that at the moment, but it's torture. So. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we could wind down. It's 5 to 9, I see. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.